Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. today. The entire hour here, number two, Dr. Jeff Walls will be joining us. We're going to be talking about the 2004 presidential election. Now, I know that everyone has an opinion, a thought, or at the very least a question on what faces the nation here in the next 8 months before November 2004. It's hardly decided, of course. We'll also be talking about pastors and politics. Dr. Walls has done some research on the not so much the political views of politics, but of pastors, but of how they view politics in their role as pastors of churches. And we'll be talking with him about that a little later in this second hour of Issues, Etc. Feel free to give us a call at 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. We are broadcasting live to you this Thursday, February the 19th, live from the campus of Concordia University, Wisconsin, in Mequon, Wisconsin. And we'll take your phone calls and questions at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. In addition to that, we have a live in-studio audience, and we invite you to come up with questions. The mic is there. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Jeff Walls on matters political, we can test him for a change. Dr. Jeff Walls is Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University here in Wisconsin. Dr. Jeff Walls, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
Let's start up talking about the top of the news I've been reading about for the last 2 days, being here in Wisconsin, and that is the Wisconsin primary results. Kerry came away with this, but there was a bit of a surprise in these results. Tell us about it.
Yes. Initially, before the actual voting on Tuesday, it was expected that Kerry would do very well in the state and perhaps even carry it with 50 or 60% of the vote. A lot of the major polls and surveys that came out suggested 55, 60, maybe even 65% for Kerry. What happened on Tuesday was a victory for Kerry, but a rather close one. Kerry got around 40%. 34% for Edwards and 18% for Dean. A lot of reasons perhaps behind a much more closely contested race than we expected. Wisconsin has a tradition of being rather progressive and rather somewhat enigmatic when it comes to politics. Wisconsin was a state that really assisted John F. Kennedy back in 1960. Wisconsin has sent to the Senate a number of kind of unusual characters. And so perhaps what was going on Tuesday, too, was Wisconsin as a state kind of suggesting, well, we're not going to go along with the script. We're independent, we're unique, we're progressive. We're going to vote in heavier numbers for Edwards for a number of reasons, but perhaps one of them just to again, throw a bit of a wrench into the process.
I was looking at the exit polls in the paper immediately after the primary. And what caught my eye was the fact that whether or not you voted for Kerry, Edwards, or Dean, or even any of the lesser candidates that are still hanging on there for some reason, whether or not you voted for any of those, the main reason most of the people who voted did vote for their candidate was he can beat George W. Bush. Does that tell us something about kind of the mood of the Democratic Party, Democratic voters nationwide?
Yes, definitely, Todd. There's a sense, due to a number of factors. One, some Democrats are still really smarting over the 2000 election and the Supreme Court decision. There's been tremendous hand-wringing in some Democratic quarters about the Bush administration, its policies, its direction. So unlike some other seasons we've seen, there's just a great coming together, a coalescing within the party to do whatever it takes to remove Bush from the White House and to install a Democrat there. Now, whether that's Edwards, Kerry, or someone else, I guess we'll see. But certainly leading up to Wisconsin, we didn't see the dirty campaigning. We didn't see the sense of going at each other's throat that we might have seen in other years.
New York Times columnist, nationally syndicated columnist William Safire was in the paper this morning. He's puzzling over what happened in the Dean camp the day before the Wisconsin primary. The chief of the campaign very unceremoniously resigned, and Dean was kind of left with no one to run his campaign, at least for the last 24 hours. What effect did that have on the race?
Again, I think it was another indication. Well, Dean had tremendous grassroots and a groundswell support. He's done tremendous things to bring young people into the electorate, to really activate a part of America that had been fairly apathetic. But ironically, that kind of a campaign, that very grassroots-oriented campaign, wasn't as effective as he needed it to be as the race continued. And there was fairly a disorganized campaign, somewhat chaotic, and people picked up on that. I guess some of us remember Dean's speech following Iowa and just a sense that he did not look very presidential. And this kind of led into a sense that does Dean have not only the persona but the organization to really make a go of it? So this latest incident, I think, just added to that.
What happened to Howard Dean? He was raising money more than anyone else. He was very early on being called a front runner. What happened to him?
Primarily, it seems to me what happened to him is he did not have a certain presidential vision and a presidential temperament that people could embrace. I think, you know, going back to your earlier question about electability, people really thought Dean was a very charismatic person. He brought people into the party, into politics. But when push came to shove, a number of Democrats said, we need someone who's electable. And as you mentioned, in all the polls, Iowa, New Hampshire, and so on, electability was one of the overriding concerns. And people just didn't see Dean versus Bush. Democrats did not see Dean defeating Bush.
Do you think, in your opinion, as you watch things, that George W. Bush was hoping to face Howard Dean in 2004?
Yeah, and several reports have suggested that the Bush White House was excited about that kind of a matchup. Contrasting a wartime national security president against a former Vermont governor who was untested, who didn't seem to have the same presidential visage or face or command. And also looking at some of the issues, Dean was perceived to be very out of step with much of America on some of the, especially economic and some of the social issues. So, yeah, I think the Bush White House would have certainly enjoyed that kind of a race.
Does Dean represent more than just kind of the angry white man, we want Bush out of the White House? Does he represent a different kind of a Democrat? He was kind of at odds with his party on the issue of gun control, on the issue of a lot of things. People had a hard time pinning him down.
Yeah, he was a different kind of Democrat. I think when we move beyond the issues or sift beyond them, what we see is someone who wanted to bring the Democratic Party back more to its roots or back to its beginnings, a party not of the middle, a party not of corporate America, but a party of the people, more of a populist campaign, a populist initiative. So I think if nothing else, Dean injected that sense of this is the people's party. It's not the politician's party. And again, that's ironically one of the things that got him in trouble is he didn't have professionals running his campaign to make it effective. And because of that, he lost support from some voters due to this kind of grassroots effort.
As a matter of order, I suppose, why is it that Dean, having dropped out now, is not taking his name off the ballots in the remaining primary, especially the Super Tuesday primaries? Why not?
Well, a couple of possibilities. One is that it's just Dean being stubborn, Dean wanting to hang on to some hope or some thread of something might happen that would catapult him back into contention somehow. So I think part of it is just who he is. Part of it too, other people say he wants to see what, you know, what Edwards, what Kerry do policy-wise, which candidate might be closer to his issues. It would appear it could be Edwards now, although Dean voters in the exit polls seem to split whether they'd go for Kerry or Edwards now. So I think it's also a sense of Dean wanting to see which candidate perhaps is more faithful to the true Democratic Party.
If the voters would have split between Kerry and Edwards, the two front runners now in the Democratic process, if Dean would have dropped out before the Wisconsin primary, would that have meant that Edwards would have had a better chance of beating Kerry and getting his first victory over, well, his second victory over Kerry in the primary season?
he might have had a better chance. There's this idea of momentum, where if you have a sense of momentum, you're an underdog, yet you're in striking distance, that might bring more of the vote to you. Although, again, looking at the exit polls, when you look at Kerry voters and Edwards voters, there was still a strong sense among the Kerry voters that they wanted someone to beat Bush. And the Dean voters kind of came out about half and half on that as well. So it would have helped Edwards, but I still think Kerry would have prevailed.
Edwards has been referred to in the press as everyone's second choice. Everyone loves him, but he's the second choice. Is there a chance, since he now seems to be kind of very closely trailing Kerry with another victory, or at least another near victory, is there a chance that he could be a running mate to John Kerry when they finally shake this thing out?
Yeah, most definitely, Todd. There's one school of thought that says Edwards is being such a good campaigner, such a high-minded politician, not attacking Kerry or Dean or whomever else previously, not only because he thinks it's best for the party, but, as you said, because it positions him then to potentially be the vice presidential nominee. And what we've seen historically is when you have a very contested, very divisive race, generally the nominee will not pick his adversary, to be the nominee for the vice president. So certainly this is one way, it seems to me, that Edwards is keeping the door open. And he's bright, he's young, he's charismatic, and he certainly will go places, and perhaps he sees this as a possible stepping stone.
Other contenders for a Kerry running mate, assuming, of course, that Kerry continues to chalk up victories in the primary season and gets his party's nomination.
Most commentators are looking at someone who is not from the East, because one of the problems Kerry will have is he's viewed as another one of these Democratic Massachusetts senators. Going back to 1988, Dukakis also came from Massachusetts and also lost to a Bush or faced a Bush, at least at that point. So you need somebody from another part of the country. Some people have mentioned Bayh from Indiana as a senator, somebody who's again fairly young from a more Midwestern area. The battleground states certainly will be in the heart of the Middle West and the Upper Great Lakes region. So someone from that region too would be a potential candidate. Now other names are being thrown out, like a Hillary Clinton. I kind of doubt we'd have a very high profile candidate. Barbara Boxer, Dianne Feinstein from California senators, their names have been thrown around a bit. But again, they would appear to be perhaps too far outside the mainstream to bring in some of those more middle America voters.
When you ask the question, why not a Kerry Clinton ticket? Why not John Kerry and Hillary Clinton as a vice president? You kind of get into the alchemy of Democratic politics in America. Why would Hillary not want to be a running mate to John Kerry when he's in the polls leading Bush today by double digits?
A couple of reasons. One, when you look at the Clintons, and it's always difficult to suggest the relationship of Bill and Hillary, but the Clintons, at least Bill, has not been heavily behind Kerry. Bill Clinton was more of a Clark supporter, and really there has not been a close connection within the party. Also, Kerry, even though he's more in the mainstream of the Democratic Party, he's not necessarily what the Clintons or what Hillary might call more of a new Democrat, a centrist Democrat, someone who's fairly conservative in a sense on economic issues, more progressive or liberal on social issues. So part of it is the ideologies. The ideologies don't stack up. And then part of it, too, is Hillary may have her eye on this top job down the road, and to become a part of this ticket at this time might be too much of a risk for her.
In that sense, I mean, if she really does want to be in the White House sooner rather than later, it's to her advantage for Kerry to run and lose against George W. Bush.
Exactly.
So she can run against whoever follows George W. Bush next time.
Right.
Why are Al Sharpton and Dennis Kucinich still in the race?
I guess if I was flippant, I would say for some comic relief. with all due respect, they're very sharp people. They're smart individuals. They can afford to be a little more relaxed and casual. But I think, too, for the Democratic Party, they represent certain ideas and views and perspectives that perhaps we otherwise wouldn't be privy to. Sharpton, a preacher, has always been focusing on affirmative action, on issues of race within America as the only African-American candidate. And Kucinich really represents the hardcore pacifistic wing of the Democratic Party. He said we need to bring the troops back from Iraq yesterday or right now. So in a sense, I'd rather only see, well, now two, but before Wisconsin, three candidates just for the qualitative discussion and debate. But I also think these candidates bring a certain sense of what the Democratic Party has stood for and addressing certain issues that otherwise might not be a focus in the debates.
Let's talk about the strengths, or let's put it this way, the greatest strength and the greatest vulnerability of the two men who will most likely face off in 2004. Let's start with the president himself, George W. Bush. Mm-hmm. Greatest strength, greatest vulnerability.
Okay. Greatest strength for me is he is a wartime president. He's been strong on national security. He's brought a sense of safety and security back to the country. He feels very comfortable, it seems to me, in international affairs and national security affairs. And while polls show people are not as concerned anymore with national security, certainly we want someone who's tested in that arena. And I think we see him as a very strong commander-in-chief, someone who is very resolute and someone who can see good and evil in very distinct terms.
Then his greatest vulnerability, at least as we can see it 8 months out from the election?
Yeah, he may in a sense be repeating some of the mistakes, or one of the mistakes at least, of his father's administration on the economy. Now, we can argue until the cows come home about how much control a president has with the economy or in the economy. But what Bush 1 did is he gave the appearance that he didn't care, at times at least, about the American economy or about the average workers. And while I think Bush 2 has been much more sensitive to that and has reached out and has tried to invigorate the economy, there's a sense among some that he doesn't really get where they are. There was one poll out that said almost 60% of Americans, this was a couple weekends ago, said they felt the president didn't understand their situation as workers in America, essentially. So then, again, kind of a vulnerability. Does the president, is he receptive to these folks and where they are? Or is he seen as somebody who's above them or distant?
Let's then ask the same question about John Kerry. Greatest strength going into the presidential campaign?
Greatest strength, he certainly matches up, given his military career. He matches up with Bush as a potential national leader. He's very experienced. He's very articulate, very fluid, very controlled and confident. So he looks like Bush. He looks presidential. And for Bush to try and say that Kerry is not up to the national security job would be a very tough kind of argument to make.
He's also sat on the Senate's Intelligence Committee, so that is kind of a pretty decent qualification,
right?
There.
Exactly.
Greatest vulnerability for John Kerry.
Again, it seems to me an image of being an Eastern Democrat who's more interested in taxing Americans than anything else. We kind of have this image of the liberal Massachusetts senator, the Dukakis, the Kerry, and I really think the Republicans will try and at least focus on that. And if you look at Kerry's voting record over the last 20 years or so, there is some evidence to support his penchant for using a very powerful government. So I think the Bush administration would use this kind of question, do you want more government or less government? And if Kerry is the president, he may tilt toward the more government side.
Now, that's a thorny question for two reasons. George W. Bush as a president is certainly not a fiscal conservative if you just count the numbers and the spending. He spends, to kind of use the popular way of saying it, he spends like a Democrat. I mean, he really does. And I could see him saying, well, do you want more government? If you want it, then John Kerry's your man. And John Kerry saying, I'm only proposing doing what you've been doing for 4 years. Is that a real vulnerability there?
It is. And actually, that's a very good point, Todd. A number of Republicans within the House, especially the House leadership, have been very critical of Bush and his administration for all of the spending, saying, you know, you're a Republican. You're a Bush. You should know not to spend as much as you have. Now, of course, Bush is focusing on national security, Afghanistan, Iraq. And so he's making the case, well, I'm spending on essential items, on Medicare reform, these kinds of things. So you're right, Todd. It is thorny. What I suspect might be the charge against Kerry is that not only will he focus on these issues, but also he'll want to increase domestic spending more. And also, as he suggested, he'd like to reactivate certain of the tax cuts that Bush instituted over the last 2 or 3 years, especially on the more affluent Americans.
I want to get to those tax cuts in a minute here, but one more question that could be thorny as a vulnerability for John Kerry. He wants us to think of him in terms of 30 years ago with regard to his war record, which is, as far as we know, untarnished. But that also makes us look back over his life in the last 30 years, and there have been some pretty significant changes of mind in the last 30 years on his part, and some of them most recently with regard to the war. How does he answer the critics on that?
Yeah, that's a good point, Todd. This is another criticism of Kerry is people say he wants to have it both ways. So he'll vote for something, he'll say in concept or in theory. So like the war in Iraq, he voted in favor of that resolution, if need be, to go into Iraq. And now after the fact, he said, well, yeah, I voted for it in concept, in theory, but the way it's been actually practiced or carried out or implemented, well, this isn't what I meant. Certainly he's got to battle kind of this image of someone who wants it both ways. He's going to go ahead with the idea, but just because it's not implemented his way, he's going to pull back. And you know, the answer to that is, well, if you had some concerns about how something was going to be implemented, then you should not have sanctioned it in the first place.
We're talking with Dr. Jeff Walz about the 2004 presidential election. A little later in our conversation, we'll be talking about some research that he did on the place that pastors give politics in their roles of pastors. Dr. Jeff Walz is Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University here in Wisconsin. Now, folks, if you want to join us with a question or a comment, we have 25 minutes after this break. Feel free to give us a call at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. A bit of a treat for the best caller. This is not typical of issues, et cetera, but for the best caller, we'll be giving them a copy of an Ann Coulter doll. If you know Ann Coulter from her many appearances, she is a constitutional lawyer. This one even talks.
Most devastating for the left and the cohesive political movement was the collapse of their beloved Soviet Union.
There we go. And she says many other things as well. The best caller during this hour with Dr. Jeff Walz will receive absolutely free our Ann Coulter doll, who joins us here on the table. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Is there anything wrong with preaching that urges unbelievers to make a decision for Christ? Is there anything wrong with preaching that tries to motivate good works in Christians through the preaching of God's commands? What about preaching that contains neither God's commands nor His promises? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for February is called God's No and God's Yes, The Proper Distinction Between Law and Gospel. This book will help you recognize the difference between good preaching and bad preaching. To find out more about God's no and God's yes, visit our Issues Etc. website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section, or to order the book, call Concordia Publishing House, weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. When you call or write, mention Issues Etc.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Terry Phillips. After a long fight, the National Education Association has finally recognized an ex-gay educators caucus. That group hopes to bring some new voices to education policy discussions. Stuart Shepherd reports.
The NEA has long officially endorsed pro-homosexual curriculum, policies, and materials such as this movie called That's a Family.
My name is Daniel, and these are my two dads, Dusty and Jason.
And it's been difficult for people with opposing viewpoints to be heard.
We are not being allowed to present all sides of the homosexual issue. They don't want to hear that people leave homosexuality or that change is possible.
Geralee Smith is chair of the now officially recognized ex-gay educators caucus within the NEA. That means they'll be able to speak at the national convention and set up a booth with materials.
To put the information out there that has been subverted and repressed, and to challenge the NEA to handle this issue in a very professional manner.
She says students need to hear something other than the NEA's official line that homosexuality is normal and healthy for young people.
I struggled with same-sex attraction, and if I had grown up in today's culture, I may not have found the happiness that I found. I no longer struggle with that issue.
Mark Fay is Focus on the Family's education analyst.
You've got to commend the NEA constituents here who have fought long and hard to get this issue recognized in a very hostile environment.
He says progress always comes down to people willing to take a stand. For Family News in Focus, I'm Stuart Shepherd.
The new group will specifically work to prevent discrimination and intolerance against ex-gay students, teachers, and their supporters. Smith says if such ideas had been heard for the last 20 years, the NEA would be a different organization today. For Family News in Focus, I'm Terry Phillips.
We thank Reliable Heating and Cooling for being a corporate underwriter of AM 850 KFUO. Here's a few winter heating tips from Reliable. Don't let your furnace filters get dirty. Check the filters at least once a month, replace disposable filters, or clean the permanent ones whenever they do look dirty. Reliable Heating and Cooling performs routine maintenance, such as cleaning filters and humidifiers. 8463 Delport Drive, Reliable Heating and Cooling, 314-423-3535.
Issues Etc. is partially underwritten by Concordia Publishing House, publishers of our Book of the Month for February, God's No and God's Yes, the proper distinction between law and gospel. The cost is $9.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information, check out our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. God's No and God's Yes, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Right in the middle of a conversation on the 2004 presidential election with Dr. Jeff Waltz, Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University in Wisconsin. If you would like to join us, give us a call, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Also, if anyone here in the studio audience would like to pose a question for Dr. Waltz on the presidential election, feel free to join us right there at the studio mic as well. To the best caller, I would like, during this hour, I would like to be able to give our Ann Coulter, our talking Ann Coulter doll. She's, of course, a leading conservative pundit, and someone was kind enough to give this to me earlier as a gift to our audience. She says a number of things. I'm not going to press the button on her again because some of the things she says probably are not suitable for Christian radio, but it's a very interesting little doll. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. She's still in the box, untouched by human hands, except for mine. There's a little test button on her, so you can have my fingerprints all over Ann Coulter, I guess, if you want them. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. A few more questions on the presidential election. Should the Bush White House be worried that, according to the latest CNN poll, that came out today, he is trailing John Kerry in, if you voted today, how would you vote, by double digits, by about 12 points. Should they be worried about this?
Mild concern, I would say, Todd. Generally, at this point in the race, when we've had a lot of attention on the Democratic Party and on their primaries, people are going to be naturally more supportive, especially this year, it seems, because it's been such a clean campaign. We haven't had this really divisive primary where candidates lob grenades back and forth verbally. So I think part of it is just the timing. And that's interesting, too, the fact that Edwards and Kerry certainly are carrying on. A lot of folks have said, well, that's even more bad news for Bush, because if Edwards and Kerry continue their fairly clean campaigning, people are going to focus on that race, and they're not going to focus as much on Bush and his reelection. So that'll be interesting to play out. Again, I'd say it's early. Recall back 1992, unbelievably, as we recall, Ross Perot actually held the lead briefly back in 92, I believe in June of 92. Things can change. The Bush campaign has lots of money, much more money, many more funds than either Edwards or Kerry. So I think we'll see fairly soon the Bush machine kind of start to gear up. And certainly as we come even closer to Labor Day and to the Republican convention, the Republicans do have the advantage of the second convention, so they're going to get another bump from that in early or late August, early September. I think you're right. Worry, but there certainly is time, and I think we'll see the machine rev up pretty soon.
You speculated a little bit earlier in our conversation about possible running mates for John Kerry. Who will be standing next to George W. Bush when the Republicans have their convention in New York? Will it be Dick Cheney for sure?
Not completely for sure, but all indications are it most likely will be Cheney. There has been some discussion within the Republican Party in a couple of senses about maybe Cheney as a liability. Certainly, he's been a tremendous vice president. He's kind of been like a prime minister almost, someone who runs the Congress from that perch. He also, however, has some health problems, we know, some significant health problems, and there is some speculation for health reasons he may, you know, if Bush is reelected, Cheney may not serve all 4 years because of perhaps a health issue. And perhaps we want someone, or the party wants someone as a VP who would then be better positioned if Bush were to win to then catapult in 2008 against perhaps a Hillary Clinton.
There's an added liability to Cheney, and that has not only to do with his personal health, but also with the fact that he has been the target or kind of the poster boy on the Democratic side for big business, big oil, Enron, all these kind of things. And the fact that for the most part, or I'm sorry, not Enron, but Halliburton, and for the most part, he's been kind of unresponsive on this stuff. Yeah, you know, I used to be the CEO, and so what, kind of a thing. Does Bush really need someone who's going to allow them to continue to pin that on him?
I think Cheney would be okay on that. You know, we recall back in 2000, heading into the 2000 debates, there was concern about Cheney at that point, about Lieberman. You know, people are saying he's going to wipe the floor. But Cheney did very well. He was very articulate. He was very forceful. So it seems that Cheney, when called upon, when he needs to respond, he will respond. And should have he responded sooner to some of these charges? Most certainly. But as we come closer to the race, I think we'll see a more forthcoming Dick Cheney.
You mentioned before that the president obviously has a war chest that outweighs anyone he's going to be facing. And he's proven himself a consummate money raiser. But sooner or later, you got to spend that money in order for it to work for you. Should he start spending now on advertising early, even before he knows who he's facing for sure?
I think he should for a couple of reasons. One, as you said, he has the money. He and his campaign have a tremendous war chest they can spend until or between now and the convention. And then from the convention until November, which is, what, a 2 or 3 month period, there's the federal funds. So there's plenty of money there. It's not like they're going to run out. And secondly, I suspect even without knowing who that nominee might be on the Democratic side, you'd still want Bush to get out more of an image, a positive image of what his accomplishments have been. So start running a very positive campaign, and then if need be later, perhaps respond to a Democratic charge if that arises. But I don't see too many downsides to Bush engaging right away.
I was trying to think of kind of intervening events that could radically change the course of a presidential campaign. Obviously, the war going bad or something like that would be hard for Bush. What would it mean for George W. Bush if we actually uncovered weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? If they suddenly got out a bulldozer and they said, here they are, and we've suddenly found 1,000 liters of anthrax or something like that.
I think that would be a tremendous boon to his legitimacy. There's really a sense now, again, you mentioned Cheney, but also with Bush. He's a fine leader, but he's not been as open and honest on these issues as he could have been. Now he, of course, has called for this commission, and he set up the commission, and I think that's a good step. But there's still a sense among some of the American public that Bush needs to be more open, more transparent. It's always been a fairly tight-lipped administration, and that's good in many ways because it's more organized and orchestrated. But there's also a sense that we need a president who tells us what he knew when he knew it. And so if these weapons were discovered, that would tremendously enhance his legitimacy as a president. Next to perhaps, a bin Laden discovery, this would be a tremendous boon. Now, on the other side, if the job picture remains a bit questionable, and we have this recovering economy, yet is it a jobless recovery? These kinds of things. So most people tend to be looking more at the jobs than the overall economy, which is an interesting dynamic too to watch.
What could happen as an intervening event that could sink George W. Bush? One of those kind of things that just says, okay, he's done. Kerry's going to walk on this one.
Something going terribly wrong in Iraq, the Afghanistan reorganization going terribly wrong, economically very, very dour, very, very depressing numbers on jobs or on economic well-being, something that affects people's pocketbook like that. Obviously, another terrorism attack, something like
that. Would that hurt him or help him?
That's a good question. That's a good question. Initially, certainly hurt. Perhaps later help if Bush were again able to demonstrate this tremendous leadership under fire. Good point.
The Bush administration has made no secret of the fact that they want free and open elections in Iraq earlier rather than later, and they were talking about early summer. Very recently, the news was from the people on the ground, it's just not possible. We will have to look down the future for those elections, but it's not going to happen in June. Do they have to happen to really significantly help George W. Bush and his chances in 2004? Do we have to see actual elections and new Democratic leaders there?
I don't know if we have to see actual elections before the American election, the Iraq elections, that is. But I do think we need to, again, see a sense that America is pushing and Bush is pushing toward some kind of an end game in Iraq. And we know there's a plan in place. We know there's a plan for elections and to bring Iraqis more intimately involved in their country and in their government than they are now even. But anything that pushes us toward that goal, I think, is very important. Whether we need to have Iraq elections before the Bush election, I'm not sure if that's necessary, but it would certainly help.
I had opportunity in the last 3.5 years to thank George W. Bush on two occasions. He sent me money. It was marvelous because there were this two-stage tax cut, for the so-called middle-class tax cut. The first time I got a check for $400-some-odd, and thank you, George W. Bush. And the second time it came around, it was $800, $400 per child. And I said, thank you, George W. Bush. Why are those tax cuts so infuriating to the Democratic Party, to John Kerry? What is it about those things? People say, well, $400, $800 bucks. Mm-hmm. What's the difference?
I was going to say, by the way, we did have Matthew in December, so that's a nice tax write-off for us as well.
Matthew,
in 2003, yeah. our son, $1,000, I think, tax credit. But I think one thing is who's getting these tax breaks. We can look at the issue of need, and I think the reason some Democrats are really mad is there was a group of those folks earning $10,000 to $25,000 a year who are not eligible for some of these tax rebates. Now, you know, folks will say, well, they don't pay taxes anyway, so it's actually paying them, and that could be a good case. And then also, there's a sense that there was a cap set. But some Democrats said, well, that cap was set too high, that people who are earning $100,000 plus should not be getting the tax rebate. So I think it's the sense of how is the government redistributing the wealth? And is the tax rebate or are the tax rebates really going to the people that need it as opposed to those who earn enough and really could get by without it?
We're talking with Dr. Jeff Walls about the 2004 presidential election. Very shortly here, we'll turn our attention to some research he did on pastors and their view of politics in the pulpit. Dr. Jeff Walls is Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University, Wisconsin, here in Mequon, Wisconsin. We're broadcasting live to you this Thursday, February the 19th. From the campus of Concordia University, Wisconsin. Feel free to join us at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Final question, and in bullet point fashion, the biggest issues in the next 8 months between George W. Bush and the presumed candidate, John Kerry. What will be the biggest issues in the presidential election?
I would say, one, jobs, the economy, two, national security, three and four, in some ways, I hope are not huge issues, just because they could really degenerate into really negative campaigning. But we could see a lot of attention on same-sex marriage issues as one possible issue. And, of course, that's been in the news in Massachusetts and so on. And also we could see as a fourth issue military record and military preparedness. Again, the last two, I think, are important issues. But the way the candidates view the issues, there's not a tremendous gulf. Whereas if we look at the first two issues, you can argue there might be more differences between the candidates.
Finally, on that issue, will we be looking at another map in November 2004, like we saw in November 2000 of the United States split red and blue, East Coast, Midwest, and everything in between George W. Bush? East Coast going for the Democratic candidate?
Yeah, I think so, Todd. It's still a very divided country and a divided electorate. The one thing that's helped Bush out is in the reapportionment when we decide how many House seats each state gets. That's really helped Bush because the southern states, the Sunbelt states, are the ones that have grown most in population. So that'll help out Bush. But yeah, certainly we're going to see the red and blue division, I think, very comparable to before. And we're going to see the battleground states being where we are now, the Middle West and up into the Great Lakes region. So I suspect in Wisconsin we'll see a lot of visits, or at least more than other states might.
You've done some research recently on pastors and politics. How would you summarize the results of that research?
Yeah, what a colleague and I did is we were interested in how Lutheran Church Missouri Synod pastors function as pastors, but also function as citizens within our country. And so we surveyed approximately a quarter of all of these pastors, about 1,300, 1,400. And what's interesting, I think the central finding is, like we might expect, our pastors in the LCMS are very firmly in this idea of a two-kingdom theory, that as pastors, they have a certain role orientation. They're focusing on the gospel. They're focusing secondarily on perhaps moral issues, social issues that are important. And they see that role, of course, as paramount. A second role, then, is as citizen. Generally, people with very high education, like pastors who've been through not only 4 years or more of college, but also seminary, generally are very involved in politics. And we did find within our Senate, our pastors recognize the importance of politics. A number of them are very interested in political issues. And as private citizens in more the earthly realm, pastors certainly approve of private political action, like, for example, certainly voting, contributing toward a campaign. In some cases, pastors would approve things like boycotting, these kinds of things. So I think that two-kingdom model of a pastor in the church playing one model, but then outside of that robe or that role as a private citizen, feeling very comfortable and in some cases very active in the civil realm.
Did anything surprise you in the results of this research on pastors and politics?
Mm-hmm. I guess one interesting finding was we looked at what we might call social theology. This idea, what is the role of the church in society? And what we found here, again, a very strong argument or a very strong feeling or sentiment that the church should play as a church a very spiritual, gospel-laden role. But as individuals, again, as the individual pastor or individual citizens or parishioners, it's important for parishioners and for congregants where they're called by the Holy Spirit to be involved in the process or in the system. So, you know, it's not something we hear a lot from the pulpit or we hear a lot at church, but there is a strong sense that government is a good thing. God has created it for us, and we're called to do so. We should be active in it.
And I was intrigued by one question that was mm-hmm. asked and the response mm-hmm. to it. Mm-hmm. Politics is called the art of the possible, which basically is kind of a term of art for saying, in politics, you compromise because mm-hmm. you only do what is really possible. The perfect can very quickly become the enemy of the good. Here's the question that was in the research. Yes or no. It is better in politics to compromise and achieve something than to stick to one's principles at the risk of achieving little. The vast majority of the pastors asked disagreed with that. Mm-hmm. They did not view politics as the art of the possible mm-hmm. so much. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was interesting. And I guess one way to possibly explain it is when we look at politics today, as you say, that it's the art of the possible, but there's a sense that deal making and compromise and settling for a half loaf somehow is a dirty thing or a corrupted kind of institution. And I think what the pastors are saying here is, at least the majority, is that they've been fed up with at least the manner, perhaps, of the deal-making in politics. That because of how the system works, it's perhaps better to be a purist, to go in with a certain goal, with that goal, and not try and be co-opted by the system or be co-opted by this dirty political process. At least that was our sense. There may be different explanations for it, but it's a sense that when the church has gotten involved in trying to settle an issue or be a part of an issue, that perhaps the result has not been what the pastors or what the church would have envisioned.
On two moral issues, there were some oblique questions on those things. What did you discover in particular about the issue of abortion, especially amending the Constitution to outlaw abortion?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a strong majority among our pastors to amend the Constitution to limit abortion in almost every situation. And that's an interesting point you bring up, Todd. We asked pastors, are you comfortable talking about moral or social issues in the church? And they said, definitely. But are you comfortable with talking about political issues? And most of them said no. And of course, the interesting thing for us is clearly an issue like abortion is both social, moral, and political. So it's interesting, and we understand the distinction, but it's interesting the distinctions made between issues that are political and issues that maybe are not political.
Let's go to a question from our audience here. Welcome to Issues, Etc. What's your name and what's your question?
Hi, I'm Lucas Christensen, and I'm a student here at Concordia from the Wyoming District. My question for Dr. Walls is, we're talking about abortion and Christians participating in that legislation. I was wondering, where's the line drawn between Christians being active in politics and trying to keep Are politics a reflection of Christian morality? And where's the line drawn between that and inappropriate blue laws like the anti-drinking legislation during the 20s?
It's an excellent question. Yeah. Dr. Walsh, you got 2 minutes there.
Sure. Thanks, Lucas. Good to see you again. The interesting trend, and I'll answer the question quickly, but the interesting trend we've seen from the 50s, the 60s, with the moral majority, the Christian coalition, is Christians involving themselves in the political marketplace to bring their morals and values into the society, or to try and stave off attacks on that morality, like we saw in the early 60s when prayer, for example, was banished. And I think to your question, that it's a very fine line. There were very strongly Bible-believing Christians who felt that the excesses of alcohol were so extreme that we needed something like prohibition. Now, to many Christians, perhaps Lutherans, things in excess are certainly something we should avoid, but in moderation, these things are probably okay. So the difficulty is what is your goal or end with this kind of an issue? And I think the folks, for example, in the prohibitionist movement did have very noble goals, because they saw the excesses, they saw the drinking, they saw the abuse, they saw the neglect. Whether we think it's a good idea to impose our values on others for an issue like that, which biblically it's hard to substantiate a complete ban, this is perhaps where we draw the line. Whereas something like abortion, where there is biblical evidence and it's very clear and it's very unambiguous, then to try and bring that value of life into society, I think, is a different issue.
With only 30 seconds here, why is research like this on pastors and politics, why is this important?
I think it's important for especially one question here. It talks about the importance that people view pastors in a congregation. There's one question, can pastors have an impact on people? And they can. And so we think it's important because pastors can have a tremendous impact and influence in encouraging good citizenship among congregations or among parishes, because they are so respected. So we see pastors playing an important role, not obviously on par with their gospel role, but an important educational role in this enterprise.
Dr. Jeff Walsh, thank you for being our guest. Dr. Jeff Walsh is Associate Professor of Political Science at Concordia University, Wisconsin, here in Mequon, Wisconsin. When we come back from this break, two guests in the third hour of Issues Etc. Dr. Angus Manoj will be lending us a bit of his considerable intellect, answering questions on materialism and the rationality of science. He's got a new book coming out called Agents Under Fire. We'll find out exactly why that rather cryptic title when we come back from this break. And then in the second half of that hour, in the very last 25 minutes of Issues Etc. today, Dr. Kevin Voss joins us, instructor of philosophy and director of the Concordia Bioethics Institute at Concordia University here in Mequon, Wisconsin. We'll be talking about two bioethical issues, the big ones of the day. First of all, the Terry Schindler Schiavo case, a case of euthanasia, the state's ability to keep someone alive or grant a wish for someone to be euthanized. We'll also be talking about human cloning and embryonic stem cell research. That's when we come back for the third hour of Issues Etc. Feel free to join us during this break, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We'll be right back after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.